Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Early in 2024, the San Francisco Ballet staged a groundbreaking, controversial new show, Mere Mortals, inspired by the ancient Greek myths of Pandora and Prometheus. The show explores the disturbing themes of those two classic stories, the dangers of the human pursuit of knowledge and ever more powerful technology, and the human obsession with creating intelligent machines. They're two themes that recur again and again across cultures and time periods, from Faust to Frankenstein, Pandora to Pinocchio. It's no coincidence that this new production of an ancient story happened to take place on the outskirts of Silicon Valley in 2024. Unless you've been living under a rock for the last 18 months, you've probably heard a lot by now about generative AI and large language models. It's fair to say the hype cycle is in full swing. Depending on who you listen to, this is either the dawn of utopia or the beginning of the end of the world. Either Gen AI is opening the doors to a brave new world where drudge work is automated and creativity and scientific discovery are fast-forwarded to light speed, or humans are about to lose our crown as the most intelligent beings on the planet and will soon be destroyed by malevolent machines. Putting aside for a moment the profound implications for the future of the species and the planet, the rise of AI poses some fascinating questions about human nature and really drives at the very essence of what it means to be human. What is consciousness? Could AIs ever become conscious? And does it matter? Can we ever properly understand the brain? Can we use AI to replicate it? Come to think of it, can we ever properly understand AI? And what drives humans to create artificial intelligences? Why has the Promethean story echoed throughout human history? Today's guest has some answers. George Sarkadakis is a global thought leader on the impact of artificial intelligence on society, business, and politics. He's the author of In Our Own Image, Will Artificial Intelligence Save Us or Destroy Us? And Cyber Republic, Reinventing Democracy in the Age of Intelligent Machines, as well as various works of fiction. George holds a PhD in artificial intelligence and medicine, and is the Chief Innovation Officer of Syndesis Health Inc., a healthcare data and AI company. He has over 25 years' experience in management consulting, media, marketing, and communications, as well as in digital strategy and innovation as a founder, advisor, and investor in technology startups. He's held positions at Accenture, Silicon Graphics, the European Bioinformatics Institute, and Willis Towers Watson, where he led the future of work practice in Great Britain, and was a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. George is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and has been awarded an honorary knighthood by France for his international work on the public understanding of science. George, good morning. Welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning to you too. Thank you for inviting me.
So, George, we're here to talk about what I think is the topic of the day, the topic on everyone's lips. And that topic, of course, is artificial intelligence or AI. Now, I want to start by asking you, why artificial intelligence? What is it about humans that makes us so attracted to the idea of creating intelligent systems?
Going back at the birth of artificial intelligence in 1956, the reason why this newborn science was so attractive to funders, especially from the defense community, was the potential, the utility of artificial intelligence to establish the United States as the indisputable winner of the Cold War. The thinking going that if one had access to machines that could outthink the opponent, then it was game over for the Soviet Union. And fast forward into into the present. Again, it's the utility factor of artificial intelligence that's been debated in as much as it impacts the global economy or national economies in any way. So there is this utility thing, but I think there's a deeper reason for that. And that's the deeper reason that I explored in my book, In Our Own Image. So I think the reason why we are so fascinated with intelligent systems we need to address that into the stories that exist across every culture, stories that go back centuries, that describe things that are not of flesh and blood, and yet they pretend to have some sort of intelligence. That's, let's call them like proto-robots, if you like, okay? And you can trace them into, you know, the Greek mythology, but also in the Buddhist mythology and so on and so forth. There's always been this recurring pattern where humans or their gods create those beings, those intelligent artifacts. And that's fascinated me very much. I mean, those stories have been fascinating me along. And in fact, they've influenced my own decision when I was a young man to follow an engineering profession and ultimately, you know, do my PhD in AI. And I'm sure, you know, everybody who's read those stories had been influenced, and some of us, and gone into science to do that. So stories have a power of their own to motivate people into, you know, aspiring or researching certain subjects. Okay, and they're the driving force, I would say, of sort of individual and collective consciousness. Now, why those stories existed? Now, that I think that's an interesting question. And I think by answering that question, perhaps we can answer your question, why we are so motivated. So I'm just going to hazard a possible explanation. I think that we are fascinated by our own mortality, perhaps. The fact that we know that we die at some point. I don't think there's any other species on the planet that has awareness of their own ultimate demise. And I think the realization that at some point we will cease to exist drives a lot of those stories where other beings, either super beings, perhaps gods, or super beings, perhaps robots, are our legacy, if you like. So my little explanation for why we're so fascinated with intelligent machines over thousands of years, not just recently, I think has to do with our impulse to become creators of lives ourselves, okay? To extend our lifespan, if you like, to extend our consciousness into the future. In other words, not to die.
I think it's a fascinating insight, and I'm immediately reminded of something I heard recently that Geoffrey Hinton said. And Geoffrey Hinton, if you look him up on Wikipedia, he's known universally as the godfather of AI, which is a title I'm sure he loves, but one of the fathers of neural networks. But he has repeatedly recently described AI as solving the problem of immortality, because the models can be transferred from one piece of hardware to another. The models can live on. And we have, perhaps deliberately, perhaps inadvertently, created immortal intelligence. Now, in your book, you pull this thread and you trace it, as you've alluded to, way back into the mists of time, the earliest days of the human species. And one of the things you talk about, as well as immortality, is the desire to explain, the desire to control. Do you want to talk a little bit about that human tendency and that desire?
If you go back to, let's say, the dawn of civilization, and by that I mean where societies sort of started becoming organized, it became apparent to those societies that some sort of laws should be applied in order to control the coexistence of many, many people sort of gathering together, let's say, in the first cities that sort of spread, I don't know, Mesopotamia, Indus Valley, and so on and so forth. So civilization goes hand in hand with this concept of law, okay, that regulates essentially the human nature, right? Because human nature, if you don't regulate it, it can be very chaotic. It can bring the downfall of civilization, right? Anarchy, right? So Nietzsche, I think, sort of you know, one of the insights that Nietzsche sort of gave us is this sort of dichotomy between the Apollonian features of human nature, right, and the Dionysian features, right, instincts. And there's that sort of struggle between, let's say, the higher parts of our consciousness, like altruism, for instance, and the more basic ones, sort of selfism, and it's that sort of tug of war between the two that characterizes human nature. And that is becoming evident in the Greek tragedy and so on and so forth. So given that sort of, you know, dichotomy in the human nature where devils and angels at the same time, regulating human society became extremely important, right? And I think it's this concept of law that we need to follow through in order to understand how technology comes into play after a while, a few centuries into the future, like, you know, come 19th century, 20th century, and indeed now in the 21st century. Now, there's another thread that I think we should sort of try to understand that goes in parallel with that. And that's the idea, that's the insight that we came across quite early, in fact, you know, since classical times, that law also exists at the cosmic level, not just in human society, but at the cosmic level. For example, in the world of physics, there are laws in physics, right, that control how nature is behaving. And that makes it extremely interesting, especially because mathematics seems to be a language that can unlock those laws of nature and perhaps the laws of human society as well. So again, you have this sort of idea that there are ways, abstract ways, whereby you can understand the world, right? Okay, you can understand how the universe functions, how life functions, you know, the mathematicalization, if you like, of our understanding of nature, but also of human nature. And, you know, social sciences keep struggling with this problem, how to apply mathematics and abstractions in understanding human systems and so forth. Hopefully they'll get it one day, although I doubt it. So that idea that we need laws in order to become better, right, as humans, right? And we also need laws in order to understand nature. And that mathematics is at the heart of that quest leads us to computing theory, where we have machines that are based on mathematics that hopefully can help us do both, right? Simulate human nature in a mathematical way in the computer so we can understand it better, but also simulate the universe, again, in the computer, in a mathematical way, so you can understand it better. And therefore, the worship of the computer as the means to understanding everything, because it's based on mathematics, okay? So I think that is behind all this fascination. I think the ultimate fascination that computers, being those machines that are based on rational thinking, right? Not instinctive thinking, okay? Not the wild aspects of a Dionysian, you know, part of self, but mostly the Apollonian features, the rational part of the human mind is somehow encapsulated in this machine. That is the best way to understand how we are, who we are, and where we live, and why we live, and answer all the questions. And then artificial intelligence is just exactly what I just described on steroids. Okay. So hopefully this analysis will help our listeners sort of reflect on why we think computers are the means to that utopia that we've been aspiring for thousands and thousands of years, where we understand everything and we can live together and happy ever after.
So to what extent then are computers and ultimately AI an attempt to overcome human failings and develop something perfectly logical, perfectly rational?
In my book, for instance, I'm sort of presenting certain metaphors that have been present throughout history in the way we understand human nature. So if you go back into the Hellenistic times or Greco-Roman times, where we had a renaissance of the first renaissance in the West of technologies. Okay. So very interesting technologies, steam power in Alexandria, astrolabes, and so on and so forth. There was this concept of pneumatic systems that use steam in order to move, okay, like steam engines. And that sort of fascinated people at the time because movement was associated with life, okay? So animus in Latin, for instance, animal is the word for soul, Okay. So things that move have souls, and therefore, if something moves because of steam, it means that we humans have some sort of fluids that sort of circulate inside us, the so-called humors, which had been the basis of Western medicine until the 18th century, by the way, because of Galen and so forth. Okay. So that concept that the human is essentially a pneumatic system, that metaphor had to do by reflecting on that technology of the time. And then throughout history, you see all kinds of metaphors again and again. Fast forward, you know, humans were made of electricity. Think of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where the dead are reanimated because of a lightning from the sky. And then now we have this new metaphor, a new mirror that we put in front of us to reflect ourselves, which is the computer, artificial intelligence, right? They are images of ourselves, and we build those technologies in our mind and in fact as, you know, as reflections of ourselves. So I think that is what underscores a lot of the narratives and a lot of the debates that we have about AI, because we constantly project ourselves on artificial intelligence. We project our weaknesses, our biases, our fears, our anxieties, our hopes. It's all there, right? And that perhaps explains why those conversations often go completely off track, right? And very often go into places where they have absolutely nothing to do with AI systems, and they have a lot to do with, you know, how we imagine ourselves and how we would like ourselves to be, or what we are afraid about ourselves.
I think this idea of technology as a mirror is really powerful, and it's one of the most profound insights. In my opinion, it's one of the most profound insights in your book. It's one of the things that's really stuck with me. And I think particularly as we think about computers and the language of computers, the language that people use to describe computers, which has very much become just the default for talking about human cognition, talking about the brain. Most of us instinctively think of our memory as some kind of computer hard drive. We think of our sensory experience, particularly vision, as essentially functioning like a wide-angle video camera. Everything is seen, everything is recorded. It's filed away in some kind of older structure in your head, and it can be pulled out and recalled instantly with 100% accuracy. The question that prompts is, can we ever really understand the brain?
In order to be able to think, we can't think outside metaphors, and metaphors are the tools that scientists use in order to grasp and understand concepts. So the quick answer is no. However, the question that you've asked me, James, is interesting also if we look at it from the perspective of AI. So could AI, for instance, be, again, a metaphor in order to help us understand the human brain? I'm asking this question, if you like, because that was the key question that I had asked myself when I was really young, because I was interested in the human brain, and that's why I followed research in artificial intelligence. So I was not a doctor, a neurologist, or a neuroscientist, so I couldn't follow those paths. So I attempted the path through AI in order to understand the human brain some more. So maybe just a couple of thoughts there for the benefit of your users. In terms of artificial intelligence, there's always been two schools of thought in AI. One school of thought was regarding AI systems as logical machines, right? And the idea was and this is the good old-fashioned AI systems, right? Whereby you build AI systems based on logic. And the idea there is that intelligence is logic. So if we can capture logic into the machine, then, you know, you give it an input, the logic machine processes the input, and out comes an output. Just as first, perhaps someone like yourself, you know, a highly educated, intelligent sort of a person would process data, think of them rationally, and come up with new ideas and conclusions. So that's like one approach to AI. But that has nothing to do with the human brain, I would argue, because logic can be abstracted from the human brain. Okay, so it has nothing to do with the functioning of all the anatomy of the human brain, nothing at all. Okay, so that's like one school of thought in AI. That school was dominant over many decades, but it failed to solve important problems because people realized that the world was too complex for logic alone to be able to solve key problems, such as, for instance, understanding a person's face, okay, which may sound simple because we do it very quickly, but it's not a logical process, right? So there were very big problems in AI that this approach could not solve. Now, there was another approach, and this approach has been with AI since the very beginning, in fact, much older approach, which was look at the human brain, or any brain for that matter, but let's say the human brain, okay, for now, any mammal brain, okay, advanced mammal brain, but let's look at the human brain, and try to sort of mimic the function of the human brain. So that's the second thought of AI, and is that, in fact, school of thought that has been dominant since the years 2000, right, with Jeff Hinton, as you mentioned, and others, right? Okay. Now, this is a long sort of conversation. I don't want to go into a lecture now, but just a couple of things to note that why that school of thought? Because many years before that, it was understood that we can model neurons in the brain, single cells in the neurons in the brain, in a mathematical way, that it was possible, actually, to model a single neuron in a mathematical way. And if you model something in a mathematical way, you can also model it in an electronic way. I mean, using electronic gates like and/or gates that are used on a chip, right? And that was like an amazing insight, which was then taken over by the AI researchers, and they came up with the artificial neuron, okay, which actually worked, right? That was back in the late 1940s, actually. Right, that was the first artificial neuron that was simulated in a computer. The problem at that time was, and that's why it took us several decades to come into the present, was because those things, once you started scaling them, required massive parallel computations, which was really hard to do in the available computers that we had over many years. Right, this thing has changed now. We have a lot of computers that can do parallel processing, and somehow this concept, this of mimicking the human brain in the AI, kind of like bloomed. All right. Okay. Now we can explore more on this subject, but just to finish off by saying, and referring to your original question, the way we build systems right now, whether they are sort of transformer technologies for large language models or sort of neural networks, convolution, et cetera, are based in a rather simplistic, I would say overly simplistic, concept of the human brain, okay, that is sort of, you know, very kind of like superficially influenced by neuroscience and neurophysiology of the brain, but it's not really looking into how we can actually sort of, you know, understand the brain, right? And once we understand the brain, then maybe we can build intelligent machines. Those kind of like things, although they are sort of, they cross-fertilize from time to time. They're moving into different directions as we speak. Okay, but I think regardless of AI, which is sort of scaling towards a different kind of approach, is like an airplane, if you like. Okay, to fly an airplane, the airplane doesn't have to flap its wings just as a bird would, as nature does it. Okay, humans have invented a way to fly that is not of nature, right? We don't have jet engines in nature, right? It's a human invention, right? So in a similar way, I would say we have invented AI that does intelligent things in a different way than nature has evolved creatures to do intelligent things, all right? So, yeah. Sorry, I think I've gone off a little bit off track, but hopefully it was, you know, something of use to your listeners.
No, definitely was. And I'm going to pick up on a couple of things you said there. I think one, the insight, and I think the face is a great example. There's countless others, right, of, you know, earlier AIs really struggling to differentiate between, you know, sheep and balls of fluff and dogs and chairs and things which the average 5-year-old human can do instantly. But you know, for a long time, the most sophisticated AIs really couldn't do. But I think your remark that essentially AI researchers have had to find another way of solving the problem, have had to find another route to intelligence other than pure logic, I think is a really interesting insight, because there's so much caricaturing of human nature and human intelligence. A lot of us and a lot of our institutions, a lot of our default ways of doing things assume perfect rationality, assume that humans are perfectly logical. It's very interesting and somewhat ironic that the sort of end point of computer research, at least at this stage, is to actually start to move away from pure logic and start to move towards more of an approximation. I love that analogy of a plane flies without flapping its wings. It's almost a brute force way of solving the problem. I also think it's absolutely fascinating that if you look at generative AI now and large language models, one of the things that I found most surprising when I started using them, and I think will probably surprise a lot of the listeners, is actually this interpretability question, that the nature of the models is such, there isn't actually a straight line from what I input to the output. And there is obviously a lot of research going on to try and understand, but much of the time it is a black box. We don't know exactly why it produces the output it produces. We can't necessarily predict why certain inputs will produce those outputs. And it strikes me that, deliberately or not, we've created a technology that mirrors humans.
The reason perhaps that we are sort of flabbergasted by this phenomenon is that computers or computing underwent a transition phase from predictability to unpredictability because of the introduction of complexity. And that is the problem with complexity. The problem with complexity is that it essentially becomes a black box and that resists any kind of reductive approach. Okay. That's as simple as that. Like going back to the human brain, let's say, since we're using that as a reference point, we don't understand how a human processes any input and comes out with any output. There is no way to trace in the human brain the actual path that sensory information follows to go into the brain. I mean, we can to a certain extent, but at some point we lose it. And at that point is when, you know, when consciousness hits, which remains mysterious. And I think it remains mysterious because it has to do with the complexity of the brain. It has to do with complexity being a generator of so-called emergent phenomena, phenomena that are unpredictable. Okay. And that's what we are facing now with this technology, with AI. Okay, AI systems have become very complex. They will become even more complex in the as we move forward, because we also found out that the more complex they are, the more intelligent they become. Okay, there is a straight correlation between how the systems scale and how effective they are. So everybody's just pouring money into making them bigger and bigger and bigger, right? The bigger they become, obviously, the more complex they become. And they're already behaving in unpredictable ways. For instance, they seem to have common sense. They seem to have what we call sort of instinctive understanding of physics of this world without having been programmed like that. They know, for instance, you know, that things will fall towards the ground, you know, on planet Earth, without anyone having programmed them. They infer those things. They infer basic physics about the world, for instance. You know, that is something fascinating. I find that fascinating because I've been struggling as an AI researcher over decades with a key problem, which is called common sense. Okay, and that had been one of the big challenges in AI, common sense, right? Common sense is about a lot, has to do with what we call tacit knowledge, knowledge that exists in human beings, but we don't articulate it when we, for example, asked, oh, how, James, how did you come up with that conclusion, right? Let's say, okay, and you're a machine now, and I'm asking you that question, but maybe you come up with an answer as you would if you were a human, but that answer omits tacit knowledge that you, even you yourself, are not aware of, but still it plays a role in, you know, coming out with the output. Okay. Even worse, you know, neuroscience is teaching us that basically when we are asked to explain our thinking, we are making it up at that point. We don't even know what happened in our brains, but we kind of like invent an explanation, right? And that comes a posteriori, right? After things have happened. So that is why we are sort of struggling right now with this dilemma about intelligent machines, because we think we have been thinking of machines as something predictable, even something that you can turn it off, right? I hear a lot of people saying, oh, what will happen if we get super intelligence, right? And this super intelligence starts sort of, you know, setting up its own goals, and maybe one of those goals is get rid of those humans, you know, they pollute the atmosphere, I don't know, whatever. For whatever reason, that super intelligence decides to sort of do away with us. Then some people say, oh, we'll pull the plug. Well, good luck with that. Okay. All right. I'm sure that the super intelligence will have thought of that before you and would therefore have made already plans of plugs not being possible to unplug. Okay. That is an emergent behavior. Pretty cool. So that's where we are right now. This is the dilemma we have. Can we trust highly complex machines that become more and more intelligent as we scale? Can we trust those machines to be our friends? That is the question.
That is the question. And spoiler alert, listeners, I am going to ask George that question explicitly in a moment or two. But before I do, I want to pick up on one thing you said there, which again is an insight I absolutely love. And it's that somewhat perverse or somewhat unexpected, I think, insight that we as humans don't have access to the workings of our brains. We can't explain why we did something or why we didn't do something. All we can do is come up with a plausible story. And as you say, generative AI is in the same place. And I've tried this, I'm sure many of the listeners will have tried this, asking ChatGPT or Claude or whatever why it came up with a particular answer. And it's great at producing a really plausible explanation of why it did or didn't. I think you talk about this in your book, but it's whenever I encounter this, I immediately think of the famous split brain experiments, Roger Sperry, Mike Gazzaniga, way back in the 70s, I think, demonstrated this capacity, this fact that the left hemisphere of the brain is constantly coming up with plausible stories.
As a non-neurologist and as an AI sort of scientist, if you like, what I find fascinating about that is that you have a system behaving in certain ways because of complex phenomena and emergent phenomena that happen in its so-called hardware, right? And you have like those behaviors, right? So there isn't sort of, again, there's two schools of thought about how to understand this. One might be sort of the behavioralist sort of approach, whereby, you know, the system is a black box, okay? And you examine its behavior, you set up experiments, for instance, to understand behavior and all different patterns of behavior contingent on circumstances or whatever inputs. And then from that, you can surmise, you can infer the boundaries of the system. Right? So the system can, you know, these are the sort of the extremes, and within those extremes, the system behaves that way, and kind of like, you know, establish some sort of predictability of how the system might behave, you know, how the system is bound, let's say, what conditions bound the system. That's like one approach, okay, behavioralist approach. And that behavioralist approach is very evident in AI as well. The Turing test, for instance, you know, the imitation game that Turing came up with is essentially a behaviorist test for AI. Okay, so you don't know if it's a human or a not human, and from the responses, from the way it behaves, you kind of like, you know, sort of trying to guess if that's a machine or it's not a machine. And if you cannot guess, or if you guess wrongly that it's a human and it's indeed a machine, then the machine ought to be considered an intelligent machine, right? Based on its behavior, its output, all right? But then there's another school of thought, very much the neuroscientist approach, right? The dissector's lab, okay, where we take the brain and just cut it up in pieces, you know, put it in an MRI, an fMRI, whatever. You know, we need to understand the internal working, right? And this, of course, we need both those schools in order to understand both human brain, but also I think ultimately we will need both schools of thought to understand those complex things that we just created called, you know, generative AI or sort of, you know, very advanced AI systems. We need both, okay? Understanding the outputs, understanding how they operate, what are the boundaries, et cetera, but also trying to understand inside the system. And there's various techniques to understand how inferences take place. I mean, the transformers are not mysterious. They are, you know, very well understood. And transformers, the technology, as you know, behind large language models. But it's the complexity of the systems that you know, makes it an interesting play. So I think we will need both those approaches in order to understand what's going on in those systems. Okay, but I think whatever approach we take, unless we think this through very, very carefully, I think we're already down a very slippery road towards unthinkingly develop systems that would be so much more intelligent than us that we would be challenged enormously in controlling them. I didn't used to worry about that very much when I was writing my book, which was published, I think, in 2015. I felt as many at the time that, you know, artificial general intelligence and superintelligence was many, many years in the future. I think everything changed with the publication of Transformer, the idea of Transformers in 2017. That kind of like changed everything. And that kind of changed my mood as well, by the way.
Yes. I think for a long time, it felt like science fiction. It felt like the kind of almost paranoid delusions, to be honest, of people who spent too long indoors looking at computers. This idea that we might ever create AGI, that we might ever create conscious machines. And I reflect on the Turing test. And when I first heard that term, when I first learned about that concept, which was probably 20, 25 years ago in a philosophy class, it seemed so hypothetical and so far into the future that a machine might ever pass that. I think it's fair to say we're well beyond that now, and the Turing test has well and truly been passed. I guess the question that then begs is almost, so what? We've developed machines that pass the test for intelligence. Are they conscious? Could they be conscious? Does it matter?
There is a various level of consciousness that are fairly well defined if you're an anesthesiologist, let's say, in a hospital. So there's a medical definition of it, but I think for the purposes of this conversation, we probably need to sort of concentrate on a specific part, a specific, you know, part of that spectrum, which is self-awareness, which is associated with high degree consciousness, meaning that the being that has self-awareness knows, understands that it is he, she, they that are having thoughts that are an actor in whatever surrounds them. And it appears, I mean, so far only a few creatures on the planet seem to have self-awareness. You know, humans, obviously, apes, our fellow apes, octopuses, some birds, not the rest, it appears, right? So that's something that when we think of consciousness, we probably think of that, you know, being self-aware, okay, being self-aware. Now, so far, we don't know what is the neural correlate of self-awareness. We cannot trace a mechanism in the brain that we can associate, correlate, right, not associate, correlate directly with the emergence of consciousness. I mean, I think personally we're very close, but we're not there yet. There is a lot of philosophical debate and various philosophers are discussing this. I'm just going to mention just one idea, which is goes by the terms the hard problem of consciousness. And if I was to summarize what that means, and is relevant to your question, James, is that no matter how much observation you can do of the human brain, ultimately, the subject itself needs to report the subjective experience. That means you cannot have an objective observation of consciousness. And this is at the heart of science. Science, if we want to do science, we need to have observers observing a phenomenon, right? So I cannot observe your consciousness, essentially, James, right? I can observe your brain functioning, that I can do, right? But I need to ask you, okay, now that I see this part of your brain flashing, right? What is it that you're thinking? Okay, and you need to report to me, right? If you don't report to me, I do not have access to the contents of your consciousness. So consciousness seems, and that's the hard problem, to be forever sealed from scientific observation because we need the subjective reporting of the content. Okay. If that happens with humans, that obviously happens with computers as well. I mean, why should computers be different, right? Okay, we're talking about complex systems with emergent properties, right? So again, will those machines be conscious? Perhaps. Maybe they appear to us to be self-conscious in the same way that you appear to me that you're self-conscious, right? Why? Because I am self-conscious and therefore I assume by your behavior that you are too. But how would I know? Maybe you're a zombie, James. I don't know. Maybe you're pretending to be conscious. I don't really know, quite frankly. Right, I have to trust you on this, and I think the same problem will happen with computers, right? Okay, so already, for instance, if you go and talk to those, like chat with those machines, they will respond back in a similar way that fictitious character in the film responds to her sort of user, right? And interestingly, we've been seeing these things, but we've already seen more and more sort of people, mostly young men, getting attached to those artificial sort of voices, right? Because they get a lot of empathy from them. They relate to them because there's some kind of relationship happening between two actors, right? And that, I think, this is very fascinating. As a new phenomenon where we fall in love with the machines. Right, we've been falling in love with machines in books and novels and films so far, but now we see it in real life. Okay, right. Do we need those machines to be conscious? Not really. You know, we don't need those machines to be conscious in order to, deliver the utility that we imagine they will. Let's say in solving problems in healthcare, in physics, in material science. Helping us, in fact, accelerate massively our technological civilization, because that is really what's at stake here. That's the big dilemma, right? The big dilemma is, how far do we go with AI, right? How far do we go with AI? Because we can see clearly that there's huge advantage of having those machines, right? Conscious or not, okay? Pretending to be conscious or not. If they can help us, develop new drugs, if they can develop, if we can help us develop ways to, explore the solar system and beyond, all those problems that we have, which are problems, in fact, of intelligence, right? Of understanding and building and thinking through engineering problems, ultimately. If we can use those machines to accelerate that, so instead of having, taking 70 years to build the next sort of, rocket propellant machine or whatever, it takes us like a week, then that is a huge, huge, huge help, right? If we can, create ways to solve famine find ways of optimizing economic resources. It's just amazing what they could do for us, right? So that's on the positive side. Okay, conscious or not. On the other side, can we trust them, right? Will they serve us, in other words? Because right now they are our servants, you see. We are the masters. But what will happen if their roles change, What will happen then? Right, so that's the danger. I think that's the big dilemma here, right? And perhaps this is worth exploring. I have a little point of view on that, But I think, you know, regardless of my little point of view, this is the big dilemma here.
So let's dig into that a little bit. I think it's important to unpick. That's why I asked the consciousness question, because I suspect there's a lot of listeners who are where I was at some point in the recent past, listening to this, thinking, yeah, but consciousness is probably something to do with life. Is consciousness just a function of intelligence? Will consciousness emerge? Is it an emergent property, as you say, of complexity or of intelligence? And perhaps being a bit skeptical about that. But I think it's important for us to say, almost park that question, because wherever you stand on that question, there are still dangers. There's almost what I would term, and I'm doing this knowingly, ironically, the sort of the trivial dangers that, you know, you use AI to weaponize content and create mass disinformation, which, by the way, a couple of years ago would have seemed like a doomsday scenario. Now I'm bracketing it in the trivial category, which I think suggests where how far we've come, how quickly. Yeah. But before we get to the sort of the other end of the spectrum, the HAL 9000 super intelligence trying actively to destroy us, there's the middle ground of, I think we'd term it the alignment problem. And you alluded to it earlier, where if AIs start to create their own subordinate goals, we run a big risk there. And that to me, as a non-expert AI, but that to me seems like something we should really, really worry about, because it doesn't seem to me like a massive stretch that we're going to get there with that technology in a matter of months.
Is this concept of exponential advancement in AI, exponential rather than linear, right? And, you know, many people are referring to exponential because it is important, you know, the way the pace at which those systems grow is not linear. It's exponential. They double every sort of unit of time, whatever unit of time you want. Is it months or is it a year, right? And the problem with that is that, to use the word that you used, they are misaligned with our cognitive perception of nature, right? Our evolution has made our brains capable of understanding phenomena that sort of change gradually rather than suddenly. And it's made us so that we have this sort of fight or flight instinct. So when things happen suddenly, we really freak out and we take some sort of action, right? That's why. Okay. Otherwise, we will be freaked out all the time, for instance, right? Or, you know, we'll be just, you know, completely being eaten by lions by now. So we need to... So that is the element of surprise, therefore, you know, is built into our cognitive systems when some things change rapidly, right? And the way we react with surprise is a non-rational way. We can't deal with sudden surprise in a rational way, right? It's a flight instinct, okay? So we are not equipped, in other words, to deal with exponential phenomena, right? We're not equipped to deal rationally with exponential phenomena. We're just not. No, we're not building. And that is a big challenge for AI, okay? Now that's, excuse me, that's the first big challenge, right, that we have. And we must be aware of that, okay? Especially when I hear about, you know, alignment and all that. I don't take those things seriously, quite frankly, James. You know, alignment would be nice if we had, you know, like, I don't know, scientists working on the project for 2 or 3 years, you know, happily in some sort of lab, and then they came out and told us what happened. You know, in 3 months from now, AI will probably reach, who knows, maybe already consciousness machines are somewhere. Or, you know, it's just going to happen too fast. We don't have the luxury of that. Let's put it this way. The second thing that I need to mention is that AI is not the first technology that threatens our existence. Okay? I'm just going to mention a couple. Nuclear energy, for instance, right? You know, we can blow ourselves up. You know, there'll be the end of civilization and the end of life. Okay, and, you know, and we all know that. So, and because we know that, you know, human beings, societies, even societies that were sort of enemies with each other, so they try to figure out a way whereby, you know, they can limit that threat. Okay, we had an international convention and so on and so forth. Okay, so we try to sort of limit nuclear weapons. Biological warfare, that's another example, right? And say gain function experiments, for instance, in level 4 biological labs, like in Wuhan, for instance. Again, there is a way of editing viruses and making pathogens extremely dangerous. There is some value, perhaps, I don't know, debatable in researching those things. But again, we do that in, you know, extremely well-controlled labs. We just don't have them available, you know, on market shelves, right? Okay, again, because this thing can kill us, can wipe us out. So we have ways of governing technologies, right, that we think are useful for human society. And at the same time, they present us with an existential threat. And I believe that this is how we should handle AI systems right now. Okay, we should handle them in the similar way, not in the way we handle them now, where we have, you know, those big companies kind of like, you know, building those AI systems, you know, getting billions of dollars being poured in, and there is, you know, okay, everybody's happy. You know, wow, this the new version of XYZ system can do so much more. And we just go down that path sort of, you know, very merrily and very absentmindedly. I think that is the wrong way of doing it. Because there is an existential threat here for human nature, for humankind, not human nature, humankind. Okay. And as I said, I didn't used to be an alarmist. I thought, you know, I thought I was quite naive. I'm less naive now. Okay. So what I would suggest is, because as I said, there's enormous utility in AI systems. We don't really want to, you know, stop research. We don't want to stop, you know, those systems. And besides, you know, if we stop them, let's say in Australia or in the UK or whatever, you know, who knows what's going to happen in other countries, right? It's also a competition right now, global. The geopolitics have a play in this as well. Okay. With China, for instance, you know, building their own AI systems. And now there's a company, there's like a, you know, there's an arms race around AI. So perhaps we need to come together, like all nations in the world, and think this problem through and come up with some sort of ideas. Perhaps the idea is to sort of, you know, do what we do with biological sort of pathogens, you know, build labs, islands, if you like, that are isolated from the rest of our sort of infrastructure. So those systems are developed and advanced and researched within firewalls, okay, with computing islands, if you like, that are not connected to our grid, they're not connected then anywhere, okay? So they have their own plugs, if you like. If the system, you know, keeps the plug, it will only keep it plugged within that island, okay? And then there we can, you know, indeed, you know, explore the systems to the end and maybe have, you know, more benign systems available for everyone else, right? So have that separation. Not have advanced AI systems continuously researched and made available, you know, through a subscription to everybody and being interconnected with on the web. You know, I think that is a very dangerous road, quite frankly. Okay. So yeah, that's my little point of view on this that I mentioned before.
It's worth stressing you are by no means alone in this point of view. And many people who know a lot more about AI than I do, including the likes of Hinton and some of the other pioneers of this technology, agree with you. I think the point about the technology being exponential is really key. And whenever I hear of the word exponential, which, by the way, is often overused, it's not being overused in this case, I think back to the early days of the pandemic and the projections about the number of infections. And I'm sure many of the listeners will recall being somewhat bemused seeing these graphs on the news where, well, there's two cases, there'll be six cases tomorrow, and by the end of 3 weeks' time, there'll be 7 million cases. And as you say, we're completely ill-equipped to process that kind of calculation. It just makes no sense. But that is what exponential means. And in this case, the fear is the technology is improving so quickly, it's scaling so quickly, the models are getting bigger and bigger. What is that? I think GPT-4 is 70 billion parameters, 140 gigabytes of model outputs. But the fear is very much that we reach a certain threshold and then the AI can actually be used to build more AI. The AI can actually self-improve, right? Once we reach that threshold, all bets are off. But it's very difficult for us to imagine that threshold, for us to imagine that happening. And this about AIs having their own goals. The famous example is of the paperclip factory.
Again, going back to what we just said before, James, because we do not know how the system solves the problem. You know, that's the key thing here, right? I think that's the key message. If we give it a problem to solve, we don't know how it's going to solve it, okay? And that is goes back to what we discussed before. We cannot, you know, if we knew how to solve the problem, we'll program the computer to solve the problem. That's what we used to do before, right? We give it specific instructions how to solve the problem, right? That's like standard computing programming, right? But that can only take you so far. Like complex problems, they need, you know, those systems to be solved. So we don't know how it's going to break down the problem in order to solve it, okay? So, for example, you know, we give it any sort of goal, I don't know, find a way to reduce CO2, right, in the atmosphere, right? Okay. And this thing is sort of humming along for a few seconds, and I really mean seconds, right? Let's presume that it's highly intelligent. And, you know, it sort of comes up with this idea that, you know, by breaking down this problem, we'll start by, you know, taking the grid off. You know, just acts on that, okay? And suddenly you have, you know, chaos. So that is a key problem that is we're faced with if those systems have access to the grid, let's put it this way, and can have the power of actually taking actions on the grid. Right. So this is the challenge. We have all those, you know, if even movies like Terminator, right? I've explored that issue, right? And Colossus before that. And we have, you know, all those cautionary tales. What happens when, you know, those systems take control, right? Okay. Again and again. And it has been science fiction so far, yes. But now, you know, science fiction at some point becomes reality. And we are at that point of reality. And by the way, AI systems are already improving themselves by themselves. Okay. Through reinforcement learning, you know, this is, you know, if you go back to, you know, AlphaGo even, you know, it played with itself in order to develop strategies of winning at Go, right? Okay, AlphaGo Zero. So we're already at that point where AI systems are self-improving, right? They are self-improving. So I think that is the huge challenge here, okay? And that is why I'm sort of advocating for, you know, massively regulating the further development of those systems by isolating them from our networks, essentially, you know, our grids, communication, energy, and so forth and so on. Okay, just isolate them, put them into a lab and do the research there in an isolated environment, okay, for those advanced systems. The rest, of course, we can have advanced enough systems to do most of the work that we need to do in our businesses, you know, in like 90% of the cases, we already have systems, or we will have systems in the next, I don't know, few months that are adequate for us to do research, right? And it will be a collection of systems as well. I mean, we're talking mostly about, we probably insinuate right now large language models, but the other techniques in AI that are also, you know, applicable in other sort of problems, we'll need like the whole sort of tool set, if you like, right? Large language models have not replaced other systems, right? We need a tool set. So we have enough tools in the tool set right now to do amazing things. So let's use them and then, you know, do advanced research in labs, in isolated labs, in islands, not as part of the continent.
I'm going to mix my science fiction metaphors here, but what you're describing sounds a lot like Jurassic Park. Which I rewatched recently with my son. There's some cautionary tale in there somewhere. I guess to finish, we'll stick with this science fiction theme. if you were to make a prediction, which as we know is very dangerous and fraught with error, but if you were to make a prediction, which science fiction movie do you think is most closely depicts where we're going with this technology?
There's a profound message in that kind of like fits our current sort of cultural milieu, if you like, you know, of people, especially after the pandemic, feeling more and more isolated, more and more disconnected, human relations are sort of, you know, massively breaking down across mostly in the Western world, I would say, right? And we will see, you know, those relationships forming between those intelligent machines and humans, right? Some of them will be, you know, very useful. For instance, you know, a few months ago, there was a paper that compared human doctors and AI doctor, right? And my research is AI medicine, and I found that paper fascinating because one of the findings was that the patients were reporting that the AI doctor was more empathetic than the human doctor. Okay. Not, you know, they were also much better in doing diagnosis, by the way. But what impressed me the most was something that I didn't expect. I didn't expect the machine to be a better listener, you know, a better, you know, person to talk to than the human, right? But that was quite amazing. And I think that is something new, right? This is something new. Until now, you know, girls and boys were playing with toys, you know, and they were anthropomorphizing them. We're talking to our dog, we're talking to our car even. You know, we never got a reply, right? You know, all the conversation happened into our heads, okay? Now those conversations with inanimate objects are live. They're happening in real time, okay? And I think that, you know, especially for you, since you're, you know, very curious about human behavior and something that fascinates you, I think we will see new patterns of human behavior in the way that we relate to those conversational agents and those machines that we have never seen before in human history. And I think that is completely fascinating and should be discussed some more, maybe in the next podcast.
Which I completely agree. I would love to discuss that. Let's make a date to do that. Thank you for this conversation. I found this absolutely enthralling, and I'm sure the listeners will do as well. Thank you. Wow. There was so much in that conversation to unpack. George and I covered a lot, and we dipped our toes in some really deep waters. One of the reasons I find AI such a fascinating topic is because it's so challenging to understand or to categorize. Whenever I think I'm coming to a firm conclusion about it, I learn something new or hear a different perspective, and certainty slips away again. I'm really interested in George's point that we use technology as a mirror. That observation that we use the prevailing advanced technology of the day as a metaphor for ourselves is something that never occurred to me, but it certainly explains a lot. Since the dawn of the computer age, that metaphor as brains as computers has become completely and universally accepted. Pretty much all of us reflexively think of our brains functioning like computers. We imagine our eyes are video cameras linked to a biological hard drive which records everything precisely as it is and recalls it accurately. Well, we think of our decisions as the work of logical analysis and rational calculation. But it's not true. Humans are emotional, social, tribal, storytelling animals. And I just love the insight that it's not true of AI either, at least not anymore. The fact that the progress of AI development stalled because it relied on using pure logic is fascinating. And to get past that, we had to develop a digital replica of the brain, so-called neural network. Like our brains, generative AI, neural networks, large language models, are not logical. Unlike our brains, we can't know how Gen AI makes the decisions it makes, and nor can the Gen AI itself. Even the experts who build these systems don't understand why they behave the way they behave. We all, as humans, construct plausible stories to explain our own decisions and our behavior. And GenAI does the same. But fundamentally, both our brains and large language models are impenetrable black boxes. As for the big question, what does GenAI mean for us as a species? I'm really not sure of the prognosis here. On the one hand, I'm sympathetic to the view that GenAI is nothing more than really capable predictive text. And to be clear, I think the people who imagine Claude or ChatGPT as conscious are deluding themselves. They're anthropomorphizing inanimate objects in exactly the same way that our ancestors imagined rocks or trees contained spirits. But on the other hand, I'm also sympathetic to the view that consciousness is probably irrelevant from a safety point of view. Nick Bostrom's paperclip example is terrifyingly plausible. Imagine a really powerful AI tasked with maximizing paperclip production. Unless we equip it with some really firm guardrails and a healthy dose of what humans would call common sense, it will eventually try to turn all the matter in the universe into paperclips. The good news, I suppose, is that if you're listening to this, it hasn't happened yet. But maybe one day it will. On that cheery note, I think it's time I turned off the computer.
You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rakic and Armani Williams, and hosted by me, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.